It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Earlier this fall, researchers from the National Institutes of Health released a landmark 20-year study. And it's a study that indicates that seven pesticides, some of them used widely, may be causing depression in farmers. Joining me now to talk about this longitudinal study, Dr. Freya Camel. She is a senior researcher on this study. Dr. Camel, welcome to our program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Before we get to the latest study and its findings, tell us a little bit about this huge pool of data we have on farmers that you are studying. This is, I understand, the third time this particular pool has been mined for a study.
This is part of a very large prospective cohort study that my institute has been conducting together with several other federal research agencies for the past 20 years. The study is called the Agricultural Health Study, and it consists of over 50,000 farmers and over 30,000 of their wives. And we have studied these individuals, trying to understand the relationship between farm-related exposures and certain kinds of health conditions.
Mm-hmm. And what have the previous studies revealed?
Well, we've done many different studies using this cohort. There are a group of studies on cancer, and there are a group of studies on what we call non-cancer chronic disease, which includes neurologic disease, which is what I study, and also respiratory disease and reproductive dysfunction and so on. So really, we've published more than 200 papers from the study. I can't give you a complete rundown on our findings.
Right. Let's talk about this latest connection between some pesticides and depression in farmers. What can you say about that?
Well, there has been scattered literature suggesting that there is a relationship between farming as an occupation and occurrence of depression, but most of the previous studies have not been able to look, they haven't had the data available to look at specific pesticides. Also, most of those studies have been cross-sectional. In other words, they looked at the depression at the same time they looked at the pesticide exposure. So we had two advantages. One is that we had a longitudinal study in which we had evaluated exposure and then followed up by looking at depression. And the other larger advantage is that we had information on approximately 50 specific pesticides. So our findings represent a much more detailed evaluation of the issue than anyone had been able to do before.
Mm-hmm. And you can link certain pesticides with depression somehow?
Yeah, we had the applicators themselves gave us information on whether or not they had ever had a clinical diagnosis of depression by a physician or another health practitioner. And then we had the pesticide information that they had also provided to us. And using these two features, this exposure data and the outcome data, we were able to find a link between two classes of pesticides. Those were fumigants and also organochlorine insecticides, and also seven individual pesticides.
Mm-hmm. Any thoughts on why this might be, why this might happen in the body, in the brain? A pesticide meant to kill insects might cause depression?
Well, you know, insecticides are designed to be neurotoxic. They're designed to damage the nervous system of insects. And unfortunately, the nervous system of humans is not completely different from the nervous system of insects. So it's not actually surprising that insecticides would have some effect on the human nervous system. We also found a relationship with certain other types of pesticides, but that's not really surprising either. A lot of these chemicals have been shown to have various kinds of neurologic effects in experimental studies.
There's been some speculation about the career of farming more generally. Can we rule out that there's something else about being a farmer that may directly correlate and cause higher rates of depression?
I think that's certainly possible, but the design of our study suggests that that wasn't an issue because all of the people we were studying were farmers. So they all would have been vulnerable, for example, to the depressing effects of bad weather or economic downturns. What was different was that some of them had used a particular chemical and others had not, or some of them might have used more of the chemical than others, and that was the link with depression. So it's not farming per se, although that in itself might contribute to depression. That's not what's going on in our study.
So what does this mean for those who are perhaps listening who work on farms or have loved ones who work on farms who come into contact with some of these pesticides? What should they be doing?
Well, I think they should be using the pesticides as judiciously as possible. They should be minimizing their use when they can and when they feel that it's important for their farming operation to use the pesticides, they should be using all appropriate precautions, using application methods that minimize their personal exposure and using personal protective equipment.
Mm-hmm. Is it also, this study, a call for the government to step in and start regulating these chemicals, these chemical tools more than they have been? I don't even know how much they are regulated.
Well, all of these pesticides that we studied are regulated. You can't go to the hardware store and buy exactly these chemicals in the farm formulations that they're used by farmers. These are what are called restricted-use pesticides, and you need to have a license to use them. So they are regulated to some extent. One thing that I think is important about our study is that we found, let me back up for a minute and say that a lot of the previous studies had their exposure was not just whether people had used pesticides, but whether they had actually had a poisoning episode. And what we were interested in was the possibility that individuals who had just been using pesticides in the normal kind of way and had never actually experienced pesticide poisoning were having some effects of the pesticide exposure. And that is exactly what we found. Even when we excluded from our study individuals who had had a poisoning episode in the past, so that we were studying only people who had been using the pesticides in a fairly routine kind of way, we still found a relationship. And I think this is one thing that perhaps the government could consider taking more into account as it regulates the chemicals, because most of the regulations are based on evaluation of what happens in the short term after exposure and not what might happen after many, many years of exposure.
Mm-hmm. So you, as a farmer, you may not be aware. You may be thinking, okay, I've treated these chemicals with care and never poisoned myself to any degree, but that still doesn't get you out of the hazard area.
Well, it certainly would minimize it. I want to emphasize that some of the other work that we have done has shown that using the pesticides with care does reduce the potential for health effects. But no, I don't think that it means that you're perfectly safe.
Dr. Freya Camel is a senior researcher on a new study that shows seven pesticides, some widely used, may be causing depression in farmers. Dr. Camel, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, here's a news story that's surfaced several times in 2014, and we have the latest chapter of an arbitrator has ruled that Iowa Workforce Development Director Teresa Wehlert overstepped her bounds when she promoted a judge who had been demoted after complaints that she created a hostile work environment. Joining me now with the latest chapter in this strange story, David Pitt of the Associated Press, who's been following the story. Hello, David.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine. Start at the beginning. What was behind this demotion and then promotion of an administrative law judge named Teresa Hillary?
Yes, we began last year, about May of last year, when there was a grievance filed by a number of workers in the Iowa Workforce Development Department And they claimed that Teresa Hillary, the administrative law judge you just mentioned, had created a hostile work environment through harassment, some intimidation. And so her boss, Joe Walsh, who was the top administrative judge at the time, basically made a ruling to settle this dispute that she couldn't be, that Hillary couldn't be, you know, serving in any kind of a management position or, you know, an upgraded position in which she was like a lead, a team lead. Leader. So that that ruling took place in June, and shortly after Walsh made that that ruling to settle the grievance, he was laid off.
By Teresa Wheeler, the director.
Right. And so then Teresa Wheeler stepped in after she laid off Joe Walsh and then boosted Teresa Hillary up to that team lead position again. And the workers who had, you know, been involved in the initial case had said, you know, that's a violation of the way we resolved this whole problem in the first place. So they filed another grievance, and that's the grievance that the arbitrator had ruled on that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so in this latest chapter, arbitrator Sharon Denderant, is that the way you say her name, came to the conclusion that actually they were right, that Teresa Wheeler cannot do that.
Right, and so. Her ruling basically means that Teresa Hillary has to step back down to the administrative law judge position and take a pay cut. And it's just another, you know, issue involving Teresa Wheelert and the management of workforce development. And of course, Teresa Wheelert was pulled in before a committee over the summer, a legislative committee, and had to discuss a number of issues that were going on in the department at the time. So this is another sign that there's a little bit of a personnel issue there at the department, and this is just one more latest example of that.
Mm-hmm. Iowa Workforce Development Director Teresa Wheeler, an appointee of the Governor Branstad. And of course, when this was surfacing in the summer, there were those who charged that there were political motivations for going after Teresa Wheeler. What about now? The election is behind us. Governor Branstad reelected. Where does this go from now?
Well, I think that there is a new development in the story today, in that Teresa Hillary has filed a complaint with the union, basically complaining. And this is kind of a new story for you. The complaint basically says the union didn't help her at all. She was still formerly a union member, and she claims that the union should have stepped in and helped her negotiate this problem. But the real next step probably for Teresa Wheelert is that the governor will have to decide whether he wants to renominate her for to continue as the manager of the department, Iowa Workforce Development, as the top manager. And that's a process that has to go through Senate confirmation, and I've been told by a few people in the Senate that they don't think that Wheeler would get through the confirmation process.
Mm-hmm.
So the governor will have to decide whether he wants to put her name up again, or she has to decide whether she wants to have her name put up again, and then we'll see how it goes through the political process.
And then we have Joe Walsh there as well with a lawsuit, because he was the one who demoted Teresa Hillary in the first place, and he was the one who was fired. What's happened with him?
Yeah, he was laid off into last year, and he's filed a lawsuit against the state and Teresa Wheeler. So that lawsuit is pending, and it looks like there's a trial date set for next year.
Oh, wow. Oh, what tangled bureaucratic webs we weave, David Pitt.
Yes. Well, this has been going on for a while with this agency, and obviously, you know, just to be fair, Teresa Wheeler has denied a number of the allegations that people have said, you know, that the department is in turmoil and all of that. I think she would say that it's part of her stepping in as a top manager and making a lot of changes, and people don't like changes, so.
So, David, will this have any real implications for Governor Branstad as he looks to the new session of the legislature?
I really doubt it's going to affect him very much. I think he'll just have to he's on vacation now, and when he gets back from vacation, like sometime later this month, it's my understanding that he will sit down and come up with his legislative plan for the year, and part of that process means he'll look at all of his appointments. And so I think that, you know, it's very possible that I think there are some people who believe that Wheeler will probably just take her name out of consideration and just go move on with her life rather than try to go through a really tough process, you know, because the Senate will just, you know, fry her, I'm sure, you know, and I can't imagine she'd want to go through that again. And I think a lot of people believe she may just step aside. So we may just see a different name come forward, you know, as head of the agency. But I just don't think there's going to be really much of an adverse impact on Branstad. You know, he kind of got through the election with flying colors, and none of the allegations of, you know, government corruption or mismanagement seem to stick.
Okay. Maybe another chapter to be continued, perhaps. David Pitt of the Associated Press, thank you.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, you've all experienced it as a driver, and since you're from Iowa, you know what to do. You're out in the country or in a small town. You're driving down a rural road. A car or a truck approaches. Just before you pass each other, you and the other driver exchange a quick glance and raise a finger. To what? To acknowledge the other person? What is that anyway? Well, now we know. Governor Branstad signed an official proclamation last week proclaiming this week Farmer Wave Week. And joining me now, the man who launched this successful campaign to establish Farmer Wave Week in Iowa, Todd Collins, program director and morning co-host at Kix 101 in Marshalltown. Todd Collins, welcome to the program.
Hey, Ben, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
This is so clever. Tell us, how did you get the idea to call this the Farmer Wave and have Farmer Wave Week?
Yeah, you know, I grew up here in Iowa and went away for about 5 years and moved to Wisconsin for a job there doing in radio. And when I would come back to Iowa, I'd notice more and more people would wave back at me, because in Wisconsin, when I would wave, I'd get a lot of strange looks and people looking at me somewhat confused. But as I got back in Iowa, I'd see more and more people waving. So I've been back in Iowa now for 11 years, and year after year, I thought, boy, it'd be fun to do something to gain that farmer wave some recognition. And finally this year, I decided to pull the trigger on it and, you know, make a silly little video and put a little write-up up on our website and Facebook fan page. And then, unbeknownst to me, it took off, and now I guess they say it's gone viral.
Mm-hmm. And you're hearing from people all around the world, right?
Yeah, it's bizarre. Germany, India, Australia, and then here in the States, Texas and California and Oregon, New York, all over the place. And a lot of them are former Iwegians who moved out of the area, and now they live. For example, one woman in California messaged me and said, you know, I used to live in Iowa, Haverhill, Iowa, as a matter of fact, and I saw the Farmer Wave Week, and I decided to start doing it here. And she says she's getting a lot of weird looks, but she's enjoying doing it because it makes it feel like home again.
Let's talk about the different types of waves in your video that you put out on YouTube. You actually, this could be an academic paper, Todd. Tell us about a few of the waves.
Yeah, you know, I sat there for a while trying to name them, and then I thought, you know, I'll just call them what they are. So if you've got your hand on the steering wheel, you raise one finger off. That's a wave. Two fingers off the steering wheel. You very rarely see three off, but you'll get four or five off the steering wheel. You will get the head nods, the points, the flicks. There's probably 100 different variations of the farmer wave, some that I haven't even thought of, but people have been doing for a long time. In fact, I was back for doing some harvest here a few weekends ago, and I got the hook, which was an older guy who gave me the hand off the steering wheel and two fingers in a hook shape. So everyone's got their own variation of the farmer wave.
Mm-hmm. There's even one that you mentioned that's if you're caught lost in your thoughts or checking the farm reports on your smartphone and you forget the wave, you can do what?
It's the oops, I missed you wave, which is you just stick your hand up high through the back window, in the back window, so the person who can look in their rearview mirror can see that you actually did wave. And I've been guilty of that numerous times, but it's always good to try and catch them, though.
That's right.
You're not being rude.
No slight intended, because you may be talked about at the local cafe if you don't give the oops, I forgot the farmer wave.
We all know how small town talk can get going, so you bet you want to wave to the person who waves at you.
So let's get to the meaning here, because are all of these types of waves positive? Like, I like you, you like me. Maybe it's not that far. It's just, hey, you're there, I'm here. What does it mean?
I mean, you know, here in Iowa, we're just so I mean, we've heard it before, you know, great example. I've said before, we hear Lance Armstrong comes into town for Ragbri 1 or 2 days, and you always hear him talk about how welcoming and genuine and caring we are here in Iowa, and I think this is just an extension of it. I think waving to somebody as you drive by just shows how kind we are to each other, and then to even people who are maybe out of state, they're driving through. They might not know to wave back, but they know that they've been waved at, and they know that Iowa's a pretty friendly state.
Right. I can imagine maybe a New Yorker coming here, getting waved at, and immediately jumping to the conclusion, what does that person want from me?
Yeah, it's bizarre. Like I said, when I was out of state, the looks that you'd get sometimes. But you know what? It's almost it's a reaction, like saying God bless you if someone sneezes or something. You just say God bless you, and it's the same thing with a lot of people for the farmer wave. It's just you drive past somebody and you wave at them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's Farmer Wave Week until this Saturday. It ends this Saturday, I understand. So what should we do otherwise? I was out actually in a combine earlier this week, and. I remember doing a couple farmer waves. What should we do differently in rural Iowa during Farmer Wave Week?
You know, I think you just got to make sure you're given that wave. You know, like I said, you said earlier, Ben, you can get lost in your thoughts sometimes, but, you know, if you're thinking about it or you miss somebody, you just make sure you wave. It's just a friendly thing to do, and there's been people I've talked to who have, you know, they do the wave, but they never knew it was called the Farmer Wave. And so I think just growing the recognition of it and realizing that it is something, and it's something that we should all be taking part in, just to make everybody and everything just a little bit more friendly.
Sounds like a great idea. Todd, thanks for sharing that with us. Todd Collins, Program Director and Morning Co-Host with Kix 101 FM in Marshalltown. And Todd, I'm serious. You need to take us to another level. Get an academic paper on this. This is fascinating.
I'll see if I can get some young college student to make it their thesis for graduation or something out of college.
Oh, I'm sure there's a grant out there waiting for this project.
I hope you're right. It'd be great to keep growing it, that's for sure.
So I bet you are you're thinking now, laying at night, not sleeping, because you're saying, well, what's the next craze I can start, right, Todd?
You know, the thing is, it's how far does this thing going to grow? And I guess the next step is to make it an annual thing and then try and make it go national. And since that's the case, you actually got to get it passed through Congress. I've been doing a little investigating and everything. So, you know, if this thing can become annual, maybe we make it national Farmer Wave Week and we see how far we can grow this.
Todd Collins, thanks.
Thanks, Ben.
Coming up after a short break here on River to River, an annual index that shows Iowa continues to take the lead in supporting LGBT people and workers. And, hey, listeners in Nevada, Tripola, and Milan, are you tuned in and are you tired of having people mispronounce your city's names? Well, we've got a new online pronunciation guide for Iowa cities. We'll find out about that after the break. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We'll be right back. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This week, the Human Rights Campaign. That's the nation's largest lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender civil rights organization, released its third annual report assessing LGBT equality in over 350 cities across the nation, including 5 in Iowa. It's called the 2014 Municipal Equality Index, and it's the only nationwide rating system of LGBT inclusion in municipal law and policy. Joining me now to talk a bit about it, Donna Redwing. She's executive director at One Iowa. That's a nonprofit organization working for LGBT equality in Iowa. Hello, Donna. How are you?
I'm great. How are you today?
Thank you. I'm very well. Tell us, because people are not necessarily acquainted with this index. What does it measure? What are the criteria?
The index measures a lot of things that kind of pull together to create an environment for LGBT people. It includes non-discrimination laws, relationship recognition by a municipality, how the municipality acts as an employer. It looks at services, law enforcement, and then the municipality's relationship with the LGBT communities.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so
lots of different things that they look at.
So let's go to the Iowa cities that were scored here. It's not that only five made it into this index, is it? It's that these five cities were measured?
These five cities were measured, and surprisingly, all of them measured higher than the national average.
Okay, and the average score for cities in Iowa is 80 out of 100 points, and you're saying that falls above the national average?
The national average is 59.
Okay.
So even our lowest score, which I think was Sioux City, came a couple of points ahead.
Okay, so the cities that were measured, Sioux City, you said, Iowa City, Des Moines, Davenport, and Cedar Rapids. Tell us about the scores.
The scores were amazing. Iowa City came in at 100. And we look at that, and we know that, you know, it's in part because it is a college town, in part because the city has been very intentional about working with the LGBT communities. The city that came in next was Davenport, and that came in at 86. And again, they've worked really hard with the LGBT community. Des Moines came in at 85, only 1 point less than Davenport, and that's just an extraordinary number. And then when we looked at Cedar Rapids at 68 and then Sioux City at 61, they're more toward the national average.
But again, you said all of these scores score above the national average of 59.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So in the news, of course, marriage equality, same-sex marriage has been a big part of it. Is this figured into this index in any way?
Yeah, when we look at when we look at relationship recognition, certainly marriage equality fits into that. And because we have a state that was third in the nation to embrace same-gender marriage across the board, every municipality ranked high on relationship recognition.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about some of the measurements here, some of the data that is included that might not necessarily be something that would jump out in terms of LGBT civil rights.
Sure. I think most people think about employment, housing, public accommodation, and, you know, we did well across the board there because we have state law that protects us. But if we, you know, then go dig a little deeper, we look at how a municipality, how a city acts as an employer. You know, do they have non-discrimination and partnership benefits? What about family leave that is equivalent to opposite gender couples? All of those things that, you know, I think people just don't think about.
Mm-hmm.
We then look at municipal services. You know, is there a human rights commission? Is there an LGBT liaison to the city executive, to the mayor? And we didn't score very well there, except in Davenport, actually. And then we look at law enforcement. And I think that for us at One Iowa, we train law enforcement around LGBT cultural competencies. So we really looked at that. And we scored fairly well there in Des Moines.
I was interested to see that care of the elderly is also measured here. Tell us about that.
Yes. Well, you know, LGBT people are not all 28 years old. there
right.
are young people, and we have elders. And so it's really important that our elders are protected and that we create welcoming and affirming places for them. And so, of course, our elders would be included in the survey.
The survey indicate anything about, because these were cities, but is there any sort of rural-urban divide between the cities and the country?
The municipality index does not tell us that, but we've been doing some surveys around the state of Iowa. We did an elder survey, and we also did a youth survey this year, and last year we did a poll around attitudes just across the board. And what we found was, in urban communities, we tend to do a little better. But when we talk to, let's say, an elderly gay man in a farming community in Iowa, you know, what that person's life is like is very different than someone in Des Moines. Or we talk to a kid who's growing up in a very rural community where he or she may not know any other LGBT people, where there may not be any services for them. We find that the environment much less supportive and sometimes rather frightening.
Mm-hmm. Based on this index and what you know otherwise at One Iowa, what are the main areas that Iowa can be doing better?
Well, first of all, we should say Iowa's doing pretty well.
We've established that, haven't we? Yes.
But I think when we look at these things, there are some really easy fixes. An LGBT liaison to the mayor, an easy fix. It could be a volunteer, as long as it was, you know, someone who really understood the community and could really work with that executive. That's an easy fix. I think some of the harder fixes are when we look at, for example, transgender inclusive health care. Those kinds of benefits that might cover not only hormonal therapies, but actual surgeries. We are talking about money, but when we talk about healthcare, we're talking about money anyway. So that would be something that we'd really want to look at. And then I think, and I'm not sure how they measured it, but they looked at the city's leadership in terms of public position around LGBT people. And I think that's an easy fix. Let's have our executives, let's have our city councilors talk about the LGBT community whenever they're talking about human rights or justice or equality. And so some easy fixes, some a little harder, but none that couldn't be done in the next year.
Mm-hmm. Donna, I don't know how much you've had a look at how other scores around the country have mapped, have been done on this index here, but if you have, can you say anything about how Iowa, how the country perhaps breaks down into regions on this index? Can you, if you would plot it out on a national map, would you
see any
patterns?
Sure, and I don't have it in front of me, but my first glance at the map tells us that in those large urban coastal cities, and we're talking Boston, New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, we see a pretty high equality index. When we come to, you know, what might be called the flyover states, when we look at the Midwest, the Heartland, we see some lowering in scores. When we look at the South and the Far South and the Southwest, the scores are low also.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you could look at a marriage equality map, right? Mm-hmm. And you're going to see the same kind of breakdown. But Iowa really just rises above most of the nation.
So you mentioned, Donna, that Iowa was third in the nation, third state in the nation in recognizing same-sex marriages. Is there anything else about Iowa that sets us apart when it comes to LGBT civil rights?
I think Iowa is a unique place. I've lived all over the country, and this is what I find in Iowa, and this is what I know. Iowa has a long history of human and civil rights. We've been the first or one of the first on so many civil rights issues. There's a sense of fairness and decency that is so much a part of who Iowans are. And so, you know, we change the laws, our Supreme Court rules, and that's all extraordinary. But it really is how the culture is changing, how hearts and minds are changing. And what we see here in Iowa is a real movement forward.
When we talk again about how this will be used, a lot of communities here in Iowa, and other particularly rural places, need a workforce. So do you imagine that this sort of index is looked at when people are looking for, well, there's a job opportunity in Iowa. Do I move from this part of the country to Iowa as a gay or lesbian person, right?
We know that that happens. We get calls from people. For some reason, a lot of people from Texas move up here, but we get calls from all over the country, people looking at jobs. Here in Iowa, we have some multinational companies. We have some very large national companies, corporations where people really want to work. And we get calls from LGBT people asking about just what you're talking about. What's it like? Is it a safe and welcoming place? Can I raise my family here? Is this a place where I can grow old and be safe? And so those issues, not only around safety, but around whether or not this is a place that would welcome them, we get those calls all the time. And then we meet those people. You know, they come, they take the job, and then they stop by and say hello.
Mm-hmm.
So certainly a municipality index like this is extraordinarily helpful.
Okay.
For the five cities that have been measured.
Donna Redwing, we want to thank you for this conversation. Executive Director at One Iowa, talking about the third annual report assessing LGBT equality in over 350 cities across the nation, including five in Iowa. It's called the 2014 Municipality Equality Index. And Donna Redwing, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. I wonder if you've had this experience. You're traveling through a part of Iowa that's unfamiliar to you. You stop somewhere, you happen to talk with a local resident, and then mispronounce the name of a nearby town. The local resident perhaps gives you a funny look and then tells you the actual way the town's name is spoken. Well, if that's a situation you want to avoid, or you're just curious about such things, a new Iowa pronunciation guide has been launched. It's an online service where you can hear how locals pronounce their cities and towns. It's the brainchild of my colleague, Iowa Public Radio classical music producer and host, Barney Sherman. He joins us now. Hello, Barney.
Hi, Ben.
So give us a couple of sterling examples of towns that are pretty challenging, especially to those who are not familiar with that part of Iowa.
Well, I would say two examples that jump to my mind are Louisa County, and Nevada. And what's challenging is that we feel like we already know these words from other contexts, but they're pronounced differently.
Mm-hmm. So how many words do you have so far in your guide? And I imagine it's
getting up to around 40. You know, I should have counted that out before this interview, Ben, but it's up at the website. I'll go do that right afterwards.
Okay. So when we have like Nevada, obviously the better known name in the country, why did you look into why someone would have an alternate pronunciation for something like Nevada or
Well, you know, I that is something I want to do. I do have a pet theory, however, and with caveats, I'm not a linguist. This is just me waving my hands, but
okay.
My pet theory is that a lot of the names were assigned in the 19th century, which is an era of print media, but not of broadcast media. So people would read about things elsewhere, like the Battle of Buena Vista or the Sierra Nevada Mountains, but they would never hear anybody say those words. And looking at the way it's spelled in English, that's how an English speaker might pronounce it. I think that also explains Louisa.
That sounds perfectly logical to me. You mentioned Buena Vista to Spanish speakers. That would sound strange, right?
Uh-huh. That's right. Now, some of the names are just ordinary Americanizations. So Des Moines becomes Des Moines, and Chariton becomes Sheraton, and Dubuque becomes Dubuque. But a lot of them are, I think, the fact that it's based on print without actually having something like Iowa Public Radio or National Public Radio to let you hear it.
Right. Barney, you are the perfect person to do this with all the classical composers and artists out there. You have to tangle with a lot of these different languages in the regular course of your working day, don't you?
Absolutely. And by the way, we have on our website, in addition to the Iowa pronunciation guide, we also have an absolutely comprehensive list of classical names, something like 30,000. They were put together by Professor Charles Black, who was a very distinguished professor of agriculture at Iowa State. Well, in his retirement, he did this for WOI. It's unbelievable. It's used as a resource throughout the world.
Mm-hmm. How did this whole project get started, Barney?
Well, it's back in Iowa City in 2001, I was a newbie in public radio. I recall you were there too, right, Ben?
Yes, Barney. That's where we met. Absolutely.
Absolutely. And I think both of us found out right away that if we mispronounced anything, somebody would call in to correct us.
Well, oh, yes.
The first word that I got wrong was the name of our state, because I'd always said it with two syllables, and I quickly learned that it should be said with three.
So give us the variations of Iowa there. I guess I'm not even that aware of it.
Well, I've come across three. There actually are people in Iowa who say it with two syllables. There are those who say
Iowa.
Iowa, yeah.
Iowa. Okay, that's not the way I say it, but go ahead.
There are others who say it with a kind of what's called a schwa sound in the middle, so it's Iowa. And some say, people say it more like Iowa, with a little more of an O sound in the middle.
Wow, that's really nuanced. I'm glad your ears are working on this, Barney. So when you checked, because you have variations, are all when you say, okay, this is the pronunciation we're going to put on the guide, do you put and say there's a couple of different variations? How do you know which one you want to put there as the correct pronunciation?
Good question, Ben. My goal was not to prescribe the correct pronunciation. I'm really trying to be a descriptive linguist here. And so what I would do for each of these is I had a kind of a two-source rule. I would call people in the town, maybe the city hall or the chamber of commerce or the public library or a school system. And when I had two people who could confirm that this is how it is said there, that would be my rule. And in many cases, they would report that people say it in more than one way. So I put both of them up there.
Mm-hmm. I think the southeast town of Keokuk is one of those, right?
It definitely is. Let me see. I had people tell me Keokuk and Keokuk. So, and also, and that's not all, there's even more, because in some pronunciations, there's an L sound in the middle, so it becomes Keokuk or Keokuk. Mm-hmm. So that's four. And this brings us to another point, which is that I meant this to be an interactive experience. So after I posted the original story, I posted it on, among other things, our Facebook page, and got really thousands of people liking it or responding. So I got a lot of good information from listeners, and that was always the idea, that anytime anybody has something new to add, we can add it.
How do they do that when they go to iowapublicradio.org?
And on iowapublicradio.org, at the very bottom of the page are some permalinks. One of them is to the classical pronunciation guide, and one is to the Iowa pronunciation guide. And then you can like us on Facebook, and when we have a post on this, you can let us know about it there as well.
I have to tell you a funny story. This past summer, while riding across the state on Ragbri, of course, the Mississippi town that we were all destined for, the last town is Guttenberg. Now I was happening to ride with a bunch of out of staters a good part of the time on Ragbri, and this was unfamiliar to them, so they only had the German to look to, so they were constantly saying Gutenberg, and actually by the end of the week riding across Iowa, Barney, I had slipped a couple of times and said, oh, when are we, how long, how many days or how many miles until we get to Gutenberg?
Well, Ben, I'm going to add that one to the dictionary now too. Thanks. So it's a good example.
Another one is something an Iowa Public Radio listener I happened to talk with mentioned. He was surprised by one while traveling around eastern Iowa, and this is a town that is spelled Hopkinton. Hopkinton.
I have heard that one pronounced Hopkinton as well as Hopkinton. What did you hear?
Yes, he said he was surprised to hear that it was almost like hop and kitten, hop with the pronunciation, with the stress, I should say, on the kitten. So it would be Hopkinton.
Okay, well, that's going in the dictionary now, too.
And I'm not sure if mine was the definitive pronunciation. There are probably people in that town right now cringing and saying, Ben Kiefer, that is not the way we say our town. All the more reason to go to iowapublicradio.org and get in touch and have this interactive experience so we can we can learn more about how to pronounce the names here and perhaps in the future, Barney, why they were named what they were. There's the one that always, I think, amuses people. What cheer? Is that correctly pronounced?
What I came up with is that the T sound is not sounded, so it's, and it's also sort of that the two words are joined together, so it's what cheer.
What cheer?
Yeah.
Okay, so you sort of drop the T, what cheer?
Yeah.
There's got to be a story behind that, too,
there,
Barney.
There has to be a really good story.
Okay. A New Frontier, Barney. Sherman, you're out there to explore it for us, and we're glad you are. Iowa Public Radio classical music producer and host and creator and editor of a new online guide for correctly pronouncing places in Iowa. Barney, fascinating. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me, Ben.
And that's it for today. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. If you want to hear a podcast of this program or any of our other prior talk shows, go to iowapublicradio.org. You'll find podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River and Talk of Iowa. Our theme music is written and performed by the River Monks. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. You can contact us anytime. Here's our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.